This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder with 7 drive modes. The Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. I recently came across a book called Go Here Instead, and I thought it was a cool premise. It contains an alternative travel list, so they take popular destinations like Mount Kilimanjaro, the Galapagos Islands, the City of London, and they give travelers an alternative destination to consider, or perhaps even to visit, one that allows you to have an incredible travel experience and also avoid the crowds and get off the beaten path. And I thought, why don't I have the author on to share his 5 favorite alternative destinations from this list? So I got in touch and he was kind enough to say yes. He's here today. Joseph Reaney is his name, and he's got an interesting background. He splits time between the UK and the Czech Republic, and he talks about life in the Czech Republic, how he started budget traveling at 16 years old, how he became a travel writer and guidebook author with no journalism training, which I think is great advice for anybody looking to break into any creative field, what it was like teaching in Nepal in a Buddhist monastery, talks about hospitality exchange, his experience couch surfing, and gives advice on both sides, whether you're a host or you're a guest. He also shares some advice on going all in on something you love, which in his case was writing. You're going to get an idea for scaling a business as a creator. And of course, this list of 5 alternative destinations to visit in Europe and plenty more happening in this episode right now. You're going to love it. So buckle up, strap in. Thanks for being here. And welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey, what's up? It's Jason here with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show, my friend. Thanks for hanging out, letting me bring a little travel into your ears today. This is the show to help you travel the world on your terms to fill your life with as much travel as you desire. No matter what your situation or experience, we're going to dive into the interview in a moment. You heard what it's about. Joe shares his top 5 alternative destinations in Europe. I love a good alternative destination option. I'll share one of my favorites that I've been to on the back end of this interview, as well as leave you with a quote to go about your day. So stick around for that. And one last thing before we dive in, get in touch if you haven't done so. Jason@zerototravel.com is my email, and you can leave me a voicemail. I have a link in all of the show notes. Would love to hear from you. I got the pleasure of meeting up with a listener last week here in Oslo, where I live, and it was really cool. So I want to give Jarell a shout out for taking the time to meet up and have a coffee and have a chat by the Oslo Fjord. It was wonderful. And I invite you to get in touch as well. If you're passing through town or just to say hi, give me your feedback, your suggestions. I make this show for you after all. So would love to hear from you. Okay, with that all said, please enjoy my conversation with Joe, and I will see you on the other side, my friend. Joseph Reaney, welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
And is Joseph only used when you're in trouble, like the parent thing? Like, Joseph, get in here.
Yes.
Knock it off.
Exactly. So for some reason, when I went freelance, when I was maybe 22, I just decided Joseph sounded more like a real name, you know, like somebody that you might actually trust their advice. But I mean, I'm Joe. No one calls me Joseph. It was a decision I made and bought a website for 15 years ago, and I'm kind of stuck with it.
You know, I don't want to trigger your subconscious at all here. By calling you Joseph, next thing you know, you think you're in trouble and you're like, you know, running.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You can call me Joe. That's fine.
Of course, we'll link up to your website and the show notes and everything. You are a freelance travel writer based in the UK and the Czech Republic. And you've written for Lonely Planet, DK Eyewitness, National Geographic, Rough Guides. And you also have won some awards in the comedy world. And you also have a content writing agency called World words. So anyway, we'll link to all this. And I mean, there's a lot to talk about here. First of all, the sort of the foundational aspect of this episode is this list we're going to share with you a little bit later. I have no idea what it is, but I found that one of the books you wrote was called Go Here Instead, the Alternative Travel List. And I thought, well, this is an interesting angle. And we've talked about it on the show, you know, with over-tourism and different things like that, trying to find these alternative destinations. But you guys actually formalized it into a pretty cool book that you wrote where you laid out some alternatives to popular destinations. And then you also include some advice on how to go to the original destination if you want to do that as well. So I asked you to like pick some of your favorites and we're going to share those later. In the meantime, I wanted to take a minute to kind of learn a bit more about your travel experience. If I understand correctly from your website, have you been sort of budget traveling since you were 16? You say on your website that you had some like cash in your pocket, and because of the rise of budget airlines, you were able to kind of take off with your friends. But were you actually taking proper trips at 16 with friends on your own?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. Really? So I was very lucky because, you know, this would have been early 2000s. So it kind of coincided with very, very cheap flights with kind of budget European airlines. So Ryanair, EasyJet. Ryanair was our go-to because it was kind of enjoyably bad.
I mean, what do you expect for a pound, right?
Well, exactly. Well, I mean, literally, we would get flights where you paid 1p and then the tax. So it was, you know, maybe £18, and we would... As me and a couple of friends, we basically decided we wanted to be as adventurous as we could on like an incredibly low budget. So, you know, from our weekend jobs, we would maybe, you know, go away with £150-200 for a week we gravitated towards Central and Eastern Europe because of those prices. So we ended up going to places like Riga in Latvia. We went to Dubrovnik before it was Dubrovnik, you know, this big expensive cruise destination. Went to Bosnia, to Serbia, all kinds of places. But we also managed to go to places like Stockholm on a crazy low budget as well. To Rome, to Hamburg. Salzburg was actually our first trip. That was kind of quite a good learning curve in terms of how do you go to places that aren't traditionally budget destinations, but still do it on a budget. But then also very much gravitated towards the cheap places as well.
I'm just thinking of my own experience growing up, and maybe the difference here is the US versus the European mentality or whatever. But, you know, growing up in the suburbs, like at 16, my world was so small. You know, even if those cheap flights existed, I don't think I would have even, like, it's like I was blind to the fact that you could actually, I just didn't know you could actually take, you know, a few hundred dollars and figure out how to go somewhere. And, you know, at 16 years old, how did you guys come to realize like, hey, we could actually, and what'd your parents think?
That's funny. I mean, people did think we were strange. I think that's fair to say. We traveled a bit as kids, never, you know, big luxury holidays or anything. We had a caravan. So we used to go to around the UK and then go to France and Germany for holidays. So I had a sense of, you know, there were places to go. And then I was just lucky. I had a couple of friends who kind of had the same mindset as me, who, you know, as teenagers were kind of very uncool, weren't interested in spending money on clothes or video games or anything like that. So, you know, our entire budget, I mean, personally, all my budget went on kind of obscure 1970s BBC sitcom DVDs and traveling. That's basically how I spent my money. Yeah, my parents were very relaxed about it. My dad used to drive because to get the cheap flights. So we live quite close where I grew up, quite close to two of the biggest airports in Europe, Gatwick and Heathrow. But to get the budget flights, you couldn't go to either of them. You had to go to Stansted.
Of course not.
Or
right?
Luton, yeah. Which are the other side of London. So my poor dad, you know, we thought we were being so clever because we saved ourselves, you know, £10 on a flight. And then my dad had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and drive us 3 hours.
Yeah, you guys saved £10.
We saved £10. It was great. My dad was definitely out of pocket.
But I mean, they were cool. They were letting you travel like this internationally at 16 really years old? I mean, yeah, you guys must have been fairly trustworthy kids, I guess. I mean, was that...
I think we were very, very sensible, kind of, yeah.
Wait, sensible kids. British travelers? I haven't seen too many of those around now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. well, we were traveling pre... I was traveling long before the kind of cliche drunken stag do years.
So, no, I only say that because I was recently in Bansko, Bulgaria, and... Well, I mean, I'm sure there were foreigners there. It was the off season, but the biggest group of foreigners that I saw was young British folks tearing it up and having a good time.
In Bulgaria, that's interesting.
Yeah, in Bulgaria,
because Prague
was
that place for a long time, and Riga seems to be quite common now.
Hmm.
I've not heard about Bulgaria being. I mean, we're kind of ruining everywhere for everyone. Like, there's
I didn't
no way
say
you,
that.
You can't go. I did. I mean. It's I hate it. But I used to fly a lot between the UK and Prague, and half the flight would be drunk men on stag do's. It is awful, and I apologize unreservedly for my country in this in this regard. And
I'm American. I mean, we got plenty of apologies to make too. No, I honestly, like, just through the podcast, like, I've. You know, this was a recent trip, so I happened to notice this, you know, this big group at this one bar we went to for après ski. But all kidding aside, I mean, all the British folks that I've had on the podcast, just these incredible, you know, people like yourself that have just done so many cool things and are adventurers. And so I'm a bit spoiled. I'm a bit in like the British travel bubble. That's not the one that you're describing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You're in the expat bubble. That's the problem. Because, you know, you live in Norway, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I live, I mean, as you said, I'm kind of halfway between the UK and Czech Republic. And you end up, I mean, most of the Americans I meet are expats. So by nature, they're not your typical American, you know. Most of the British people you meet here are not typical British people, because typical British people don't go and live in the Czech Republic. They go and get drunk on holiday on the coast of Spain. I think that's quite common among expats. You have a kind of vague perspective of, oh, all the Spanish people I've met are like this. So, well, but those are the Spanish people that by nature are not typical Spanish people.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, you can. Well, I mean, that's kind of what humans do sometimes, right? We generalize for better or worse. It's good to be aware of not doing that, I think, especially when you're traveling, like painting these broad strokes of this, these groups like this and this, you know, it's not a good thing. Not a good thing to do. Well, you mentioned splitting time. Yeah. Talk about that. I'm curious how you, I mean, you're an experienced traveler. You work in travel, but you also work in comedy, which we're going to talk about. Was that like a goal of yours to split time? This is a certain lifestyle, right? That affords, yeah, some different perspectives. I want to hear a bit more about the lifestyle of splitting time and yeah.
Yeah. So I think it probably wasn't a conscious decision initially. So I initially moved to Prague. My wife, then girlfriend, is Czech. We met in the UK, in Manchester, when I was working there for a bit. That was my only real job before I went freelance. We met through couchsurfing. Back in the day, I was the Manchester ambassador for couchsurfing. Very exciting. She came to the city and she was like, wanted some tips on where to go. And we met for one evening just to go to the pub and yeah, we kind of went from there really. So I came to Prague to be with her initially, and then we spent many years moving around to different places, sometimes because of her work, sometimes just because we wanted a change. Normally after about a year and a half we got itchy feet and wanted to go somewhere else, so we lived in Austria for a bit, and in London, and then Edinburgh. And then when we decided to come back to Prague, we weren't really ready to give up on Edinburgh because it's such a great city. So we kept our flat there, and we just kind of go back and forth. So at the moment, because of COVID, it's been, you know, there's more Prague than there is Edinburgh, but we still managed to go back quite a bit. And I write a lot of guidebooks on Scotland, so I end up going back.
Okay. So where are you right now?
I'm in Prague right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm actually in a little village outside Prague, but no one's.
Which one? What's it called?
It's called Vysoký Ujezd. It's southwest of Prague. If you go to, there's another city called Beroun, and it's kind of halfway in between.
What is daily life like there? What do you like about it?
Oh, wow. Big question. Daily life is nice. I mean, Prague is a beautiful city. I work from home a lot. I only go into Prague probably now once or twice a week. So my daily life is quite quiet. We're in a little village. We're surrounded by countryside. So we go out, walk the dog. I have a two-year-old son. So we go out, to the play park and things like that. So it's quite quiet daily life, except when I'm on a job and then I'm kind of rushing around trying to see different things. But yeah, day to day, it's a nice quiet existence, really.
When your son gets to be school aged, are you going to have to pick a place?
Yes. Yeah. So that's the debate, is where we are long term, which we don't know yet. And that's going to be a factor. But he's starting preschool in September, and he's going here. We already know the place. They have really good, one thing I really like here is they have a lot of these kind of woodland forest schools where they basically spend the whole day outside, in winter.
It's like that in Norway too. Yeah, it's very nature-driven.
Right, yeah, okay. I think the threshold is like minus 20 and then they go inside in winter. Otherwise, they're outside and like you've got the six, you know, the preschool is 3 to 6 and the six-year-olds are building the fire in the mornings for them all to sit around. And I love it. It's just a lot of responsibility for young children. And yeah, it's great. Very different to how I grew up, but I really like it. It's very outdoorsy country generally. I think, yes. I mean, Norway, definitely Scandinavia generally is very outdoorsy as well, isn't it?
Yeah. I've come to the realization recently. I have two kids right now, 4 and 7 at the time of this recording, soon to be 5. But, you know, because we live here and same with you, like you're kind of living the daily life. And if you take your child into the daycare and you're reading the books and all the things, it's like I get to have a Norwegian childhood, even though I didn't get to have one, you know, which has been really eye-opening. And it's kind of a way to have like a second childhood experience in some way as an adult, which sounds kind of funny, but getting all like the pop culture references for what all the kids grew up on here, you know, and it's like I'm learning it at the same time that they are. So it's been really cool. Have you noticed, like, with yourself or with your son, so this could be like a twofold question, does your behavior change a lot when you go back and forth? Maybe not a lot. I mean, you're still who you are, but you know what I mean? Do some of the nuances of your behavior change due to culture?
Definitely social etiquette is quite a big thing and normally takes me a few days to kind of adjust. This is kind of broad brushstroke stuff, but as a general rule, in the Czech Republic, the driving is quite frenetic and quite aggressive. When I arrive in the UK, I maybe start driving this way and then quickly realize that's really not acceptable.
You need to drive like a maniac?
yeah, a little bit. Yeah. And then just kind of the distance people keep is very, very different. And then things like, getting onto buses and metro subways, like the, you know, the etiquette about kind of, do you just push? Do you let people off first, et cetera, et cetera? So those kind of things you just have to adjust slightly. Otherwise, not really. I mean, my son's at the point where he's not speaking kind of full sentences yet. So the biggest thing really is the language, is that his day to day, he's exposed much more to Czech than to English. But then when we go and stay with family in the UK, he's obviously picking up a lot of English or speaking exclusively in English.
Do you speak Czech?
I do speak Czech kind of enough to get by. It's a constant. I've been studying for a long time. I always say I think my brain has a capacity for 1.5 languages, possibly. I think I've possibly, you know, kind of lower level conversational is about where I can get to. And I found over the years, you know, I spent time, at one point I spoke pretty good Spanish, that's all gone. At one point I spoke pretty good German, that's all gone. like basically just get pushed out by the other half a language that comes in. So, you know, I hold out hope one day of complete fluency, but I think it's unlikely to happen. At the moment, me and my son are maybe, you know, we're sparring it out. We're on a similar kind of level, but he's going to be talking behind my back very soon.
Yeah, I feel you on that. I feel I had a good grasp of Spanish for quite some time, and then it sort of just disappeared when the Norwegian came along, I guess. I don't know.
And how is your Norwegian?
It's pretty good, I guess. It's, you know, good enough. My neighbors might tell you something different, but we'll get back to the interview in just a moment. This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off-the-beaten-path destinations to visit. And there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys, and it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds, so you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there, and that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself, and that's why we're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Now, back to the show. Were you an English teacher in Nepal?
I was, yeah. That was my, after I left uni, that's the first thing I did, is I went to Nepal to be an English teacher. It was kind of the scariest thing I could think of doing, not Nepal, but the teaching, like the, you know, standing in front of a room full of kids was, I was very, very shy, even at university. Like it was really traveling that helped me get over it a bit. From the UK, a lot of people after university, they take a year and they go typically to Australia, New Zealand, Southeast Asia, and travel around. So I wanted to take a year, but I didn't want to do the same route as everyone else. I'd never been outside of Europe, I think, at that point. So Nepal, I just saw this voluntary program, which was teaching English and like volunteering in an orphanage. So that just kind of, that really appealed to me. And I really like Nepalese food. So yeah, I went for that, and it was great. I was teaching in a high school and also in a Buddhist monastery, which was very interesting. Yeah, and I was there for maybe 2 months, 2 and a bit months, and then I kind of from there I kicked off and traveled around Asia and came back in through the Middle East into Europe, and I was away for 9-10 months, I think.
What did that experience teach you?
Oh, God, a lot. I mean, I was traveling by myself, so that was the first time I'd done a big trip by myself, which was a really good experience. It made me be more outgoing because, you know, I had to be a bit more proactive about talking to people. It really taught me about budgeting because I basically had a budget for the whole trip. And as soon as my money ran out, the trip was over. So if I wanted to travel, the longer I wanted to travel, the less I had to spend each day. So, you know, I managed to find ways of traveling around. Like, I went to Japan and South Korea, which are not cheap places, but I was doing it on $20 a day, maybe, with a combination of, I did hitchhike, but not there. They're not really hitchhiking destinations, but I was, you know, couch surfing, or I was staying in onsen, like these spas, or jimjilbang, they call them in Korea, these kind of indoor baths. And they're open 24 hours and they have a little kind of relaxation room with mattresses on the floor. So I just used to stay in those overnight. Or internet cafes back in the day when those were things. You know, found all the cheap places, the cheap food, or, you know, places where you order a drink and they bring you some nibbles. So it was, I think, practically, that was really useful, just learning how to do things cheaply and see somewhere quite expensive on a budget. But mainly, I mean, for me, for my, you know, personal growth, then it would have been definitely being more outgoing, learning to talk to people, and I discovered couchsurfing. And that was a huge thing in my life. As I said, I met my wife through couchsurfing, but I also, you know, when I moved back to Manchester, we had people every night for 2 years on our couch. So I met hundreds and hundreds of people from all over the world who were coming to Manchester, mostly football fans or music fans, and occasionally some odd people. So we hosted lots of people. So couchsurfing was a big thing for me. And actually, I wrote one of the first travel articles I wrote was about couchsurfing.
I read it.
National Geographic Traveler. You did?
Yeah,
wow, you've done research.
You were sleeping in a bathtub with a spout in your back, right? At one point.
That's right. Yeah.
And still loving life somehow.
Still loving it. Yeah. So, there was also, there's a level of discomfort because I'm quite a big guy. I'm 6'5" and, I'm not skinny. Yeah. That was, like learning to kind of cram yourself into whatever available space people have was quite good fun. I think probably something to do when you are 22 rather than later in life. But it was great. Couchsurfing was a big part of my life. So that was a big part of the trip.
Well, I wanted to ask you some advice because my kids being the age that they are now, I feel like this could be a good time to start opening up for like couch surfing or warm showers or one of those things where we can like maybe let some travelers stay here. And then, you know, I always love talking to travelers and we can, you know, I think it's a good experience for my kids to see, hey, people, you know, it's just like a constant reminder, like, hey, these, you know, there's meeting people from different cultures. There's a whole world out there, people out there exploring, having different adventures. So any advice you would have for people that want to host, let's say, you could give us advice on both sides because you've done both sides as a couch surfer and as a host, maybe. And we don't have to limit it to couch surfing because this is just like hospitality exchange, right? I know there's some other websites and things out there now. So maybe some of your advice can apply to other.
Yeah, modes. I think from a guest point of view, so if you're staying with other people, I would just say you want to be as engaged as possible and not cause problems, you know. So my kind of policy was, you know, the first time you meet up, I would normally bring something like a small token.
Like a chocolate bar or something or?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Well, so when I was hosting later, sorry to jump around, but when I was hosting later, I asked people if they could, if they were traveling from their home country to us, bring us something from your home country. And we had a big cork board in the kitchen and it was all things. So, you know, sometimes it was postcards, sometimes it was like a pack of spices or kimchi or like something that people have bought. And that was great. Like that was such a nice thing to just have in the house. Yeah, I think things like that are really nice. But when I was staying with people, I just would always buy them a beer, and just, it was about trying not to be too much of a nuisance, but also, you know, people are there. You know, I think there's a temptation to see it as this is a great way to stay somewhere for free, whereas actually, and it is, but actually it is a cultural exchange. The people do it because they're interested in meeting different people from different places. So you have to kind of engage with that. What you will get out of it when you're staying with people is they will take you to places you would never have been to. You know, I went to, you know, occasionally I went to like a wedding, like someone's cousin's wedding in Jordan, which was great. But also like in Korea, we just went to like karaoke bars or to really, you know, just strange parts of town that you wouldn't know about as a tourist. And then when you're hosting, it's your job to kind of, to do that really, to help people see, give them advice and help them see things they wouldn't otherwise see. And we used to, when we had people at weekends, we would just take them. So from Manchester, we have a couple of national parks nearby, Lake District, Peak District, but also like Yorkshire Dales and things. So we'd take them away for the weekend. Or we used to organize big meetups, like cultural things like a pub quiz. People loved a pub quiz. I didn't really realize it was kind of a quite quintessentially British thing. But yeah, people enjoyed that. So I think it really is just about the cultural exchange. When I started, it was me and my housemate. We were two quite young men, so we weren't really thinking about vetting people or about personal safety. I think it's very different if you are, you know, a family with kids, or if you're, you know, a woman living by herself, for example. I think that's another aspect you have to consider. But most of these platforms, they have opportunities to, you know, have those conversations in advance. So I'm sure there's probably some good safety advice that I never took, which should be part of it.
But never had any issues.
Generally, we never ever. I've probably stayed over the years with 100 people, hosted 200. There's probably been one or two people that I didn't really get on with. But nobody who was ever like a serious issue ever. So the benefits, you know, massively, massively outweighed.
Being 6'5" maybe helps too. You know, it's like, well, I'm not going to mess with this guy.
Well, that's it. That's the thing. So many people ask me about, like, oh, what's it like to travel by yourself? And I'm like, well, you know, as a big white 6'5" bloke, it's fine. But that's not necessarily transferable advice for everyone I meet. So I'm a little bit cautious about just necessarily assuming all of the stupid, potentially risky things I've done are the right way to go for everyone.
What is the riskiest thing you've done?
Well, I used to hitchhike a lot. I basically did like the Everest. I hiked up to Mount Everest base camp pretty much by myself and nearly ended up kind of falling off the side of a mountain and struggling to make my way back up. No one knew who I was. No one, you know, had my phone number or anything. Very stupid. A few things like that. Just general kind of silly things, which I probably wouldn't do now. Just kind of, you know, anyone with half a brain would have, you know, told people their route that they were taking up Everest.
Well, I mean, sometimes when we're younger, we only have half of our brains. That's the problem.
That's true. Yes. Let's go with that.
Still developing in some ways. Okay. So you made the leap to full-time writer in around the 2010s, I guess. I guess here I'm looking for some advice too, if you have any, on kind of going all in on something that you're passionate about or excited about. I mean, it doesn't seem like you ever really made your way down any traditional path whatsoever, but maybe I'm wrong here. I mean, you started, you know, doing these crazy trips at 16, and then you went, you know, after uni, you went to Nepal and did all that traveling. And I mean, was there any sort of what we'll call it traditional path at some point that you had to break free from, or were you just always kind of like, you know what, this is just like this sort of unconventional lifestyle approach is for me, so I'm just going to keep riding this out and see what happens?
I didn't have a conventional path, as in I didn't study to, you know, be a doctor or a plumber, right, or anything like that,
or, you know, working 9 to 5 somewhere,
but
you
know what happened with me. So I went to uni, I studied script writing, so screenwriting for film and TV, not a guaranteed job at the end of that. And then I ended up going, after my gap year, I ended up working for a marketing agency in Manchester. That's how I ended up in Manchester. And then basically I knew someone who was starting out in doing some travel writing, and I was asking their advice, and I just happened to mention that I'd booked a trip to go to North Korea, because I really wanted to go somewhere different. It's, you know, ethically, I'm not sure I'd make that decision now, but at the time I was like, wow, that's, you know, there's nowhere more different than North Korea. So I'm going to book this trip. And I'd spent about a third of my salary on this trip. So I was living incredibly frugally for, and not, this is a start, it's my first job. This is not a good salary. So I basically talked to him about it, and he was saying, like, well, journalists aren't really allowed into North Korea, right? I said, no, I have to sign like a waiver saying I'm not a journalist, because I wasn't a journalist. And he said, well, but maybe you can be once you get back. Maybe you can try and sell like an article off the back of it. So that's a good idea. So I did that. I went, came back, wrote up something, published it, put it on a blog, which was very stupid. Don't do that. Because I then went to pitch to people and everyone said, well, you've already published it.
You live and you learn.
Exactly. That was quite a big one. But randomly, the editor at Reader's Digest said, yeah, that sounds good. Let's do that. So, which was, you know, a long way down my list of who's going to be interested in an article on North Korea. Anyway, Reader's Digest came and they paid for the article. They paid for photos because they had no, you know, photo bank from North Korea. I've been to this thing called the Arirang Games, which is an annual gymnastic festival. Kind of like if you saw the opening to the Beijing Olympics, it's kind of that. It's this incredible kind of mass games gymnastic demonstration in the biggest stadium in the world, 150,000-seater stadium. Bonkers. So I basically sold the article and the photos, and that's still the most I've ever been paid for a job.
Really? Even with all the guidebooks you've written and stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One article? Well, I mean, you must have made more on like these entire books.
No, not the guidebooks. That's true. Okay, so an equivalent job, I suppose.
For articles and stuff.
For 2,000 words and some photos.
Yeah.
It pretty much paid for the trip.
Wow.
So I thought, oh my God, travel writing's incredibly profitable. Let's do that. At this point, I met my wife. I'd already quit my job because I was planning a trip to Central America. And then I decided once I came back from that trip, rather than just try and find another job, I'll move to Prague, where it's, you know, fairly cheap. And I will start work as a freelancer, and I will go on to there's a platform called Elance. It's Upwork, I think it's called now. But Fiverr, there's all these kind of things where you basically say, I will write whatever for this tiny amount of money. So I ended up writing a lot of stuff about nonsense, replacement windows and all kinds of things. And then as I kind of grew the portfolio, I started to focus in on travel writing. And then on the side, I was kind of pitching stuff off the back of Reader's Digest, pitching stuff to other travel publishers, not having much success because I didn't really have, you know, that's all I had was this one article. But I then managed to win. I won like a couple of travel writing competitions, and then kind of slowly but surely I started to get some work with different travel publishers. Yeah. And then that was that, really.
And
so
off and running.
Yes, off and running. So I have no journalism training. What I did do is I went to university and I found out that I could write, like people liked things I wrote. And then I worked in marketing as a copywriter, so I knew that people would pay me to write. So I had that level of, you know, I'm not terrible at this. It wasn't starting off where, with other things where you're just like, I have no idea if I'm good at this or not. My mum likes it. Otherwise, I don't know. So I suppose that was very valuable, but it's not a typical path. Although a lot of travel writers, like I facetiously said before about how much travel writers earn, the headline is not very much. So most travel writers do work as copywriters or, you know, writing for travel brands and things on the side as well.
Yeah. We didn't bury the lead there, right? Headline, not very much. People are always curious, well, how, you know, affording like a lifestyle where you can split time between two places and all that kind of stuff. Can I ask you where like the majority of your income comes from for anybody out there listening that's curious about, you know, that side of things?
So for me, it is the company that I set up, World Words, which we can get into that a bit later. But travel writing alone, I think I have some friends who basically spend probably 9 months of the year on the road working on travel guides, and they earn a moderate income to live in the Czech Republic. It is not a well-paid job. I'm lucky that I found something else that kind of pays the bills.
With the content writing agency, are you essentially brokering like articles for brands and agencies and things like that?
So what I was saying before, how I started, I was writing a lot for travel, for other agencies and travel writing brands. So I was writing for, you know, Expedia and Travel Supermarket and these kind of things. And then when I was starting to get more work with what I wanted to do, which was magazines, I hadn't done any guidebooks at this point. Then I had too much work. So I started subcontracting it to another writer who I knew who was really good. Everyone knew what was going on. I wasn't kind of, you know, putting it under my name or anything. Then, you know, it got bigger and bigger because the work was good and people said, well, can you do this bigger job? So then I ended up kind of having three or four different writers that I was giving work out to. And then that kind of crystallized into this business, World Words, which basically became a full content writing agency. So we had kind of in-house editors who would distribute work among freelance writers, and it would come back in. We would edit everything for consistency of tone of voice and everything else, and then send it back to the client. And our kind of selling point is that we had very well-established writers. So travel, it's travel specialty. It's only, you know, top drawer travel writers. So the people that write, you know, Lonely Planet, Black Guides, Moon, all these kind of things for their destinations. And they're all over the world. So if we have a client who is based in Southeast Asia, we can go, oh, great. We have this writer who writes the Lonely Planet for Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore. She can do this stuff for you. So that kind of grew that way, and that is how I've managed to kind of make a living out of that. And now I do a lot more travel guides. I could make a living from that, but it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be as comfortable as having the agency.
Yeah, and you have to be on the road more and things like that. Just for anybody listening that's, you know, ever considered starting something and they're just like, well, what if I, you know, get overwhelmed or there's too much going on? I mean, that's, of course, a luxury problem to have. But I think, you know, taking like the meta view from what you just described with your agency, it's like that's a way forward to scale, right? You can be like, all right, well, if you're good at this and you can kind of... If you're getting too much work, that's the hard part. Like, you know, most like writers, I imagine that's like the challenge is getting the work. So if you can create something where you're able to provide value on both ends and you just bring other people on that do the thing that you do, or you can't do it, but you know, you can bring a bunch of talented people in and you have a good eye for it and you can curate those creators or whatever the case is and match them with the brands. It's like a great service to provide. And of course you have a great niche here where you've niched down to travel, and of course you have the street cred and everything, but I just kind of wanted to take the big picture view in case that hits anybody's ears right now. It's listening, it's like oh yeah, like maybe that's a way forward with the thing I want to create. Mm-hmm. Or I am creating.
One thing I would say from the business point of view, I mean, I had absolutely no intention of ever starting a business. But I also, it was very organic. It wasn't, I think a lot of what you hear is, you know, here's my idea. I need X amount of $1,000 seed money, all this kind of stuff. Mine was very much it just grew organically. There's not a huge amount of initial investment or anything because it was effectively, when I had work, I gave it to people, to freelancers. I didn't have staff. I didn't have an office. So it was not as daunting a prospect. And it was almost kind of crept up on me that I was like, oh, you know what? I have a business. it wasn't this big.
Whoops, I accidentally have a business.
Yeah, how did that happen? And I think that's actually quite key, because a lot of people, you know, when you say to someone, I've got my own business, that feels like a very intimidating prospect. And there are ways of doing it, kind of using your own talents, you know, particularly if you're a freelance creative, you know, the amount of people who are, you know, comedy writers who set up production companies, there's a cost involved in that. But often, you know, initially you're one person and you are a company. So it is possible to kind of to segue from being one person to being company without it being this huge moment of entrepreneurship.
But I love on your website that it's, you know, travel / comedy writer and editor. You're just like, you know what? I'm not even trying to like brand this, and I'm just like mushing together two things that I love, and I'm just, that's just what I do, which I think is really cool. And one of the things that attracted me to having you on as a guest, because I love that you just have these interests and you've just found a way to kind of combine them and put it out there in that way. Is there any crossover or intersection of comedy and travel writing? I'm just curious, like, what do they have in common for you, if anything?
That is interesting. Well, I mean, I know personally, I always loved, when I traveled, I loved Lonely Planet guides because they had a sense of humor, because they would make, you know, and I, you know, now I know that's very dependent on the individual writer. But there is a general ethos, there's general tone of voice, which is quite playful. So there's definitely ways of getting kind of comic writing and comic observations into travel writing. I mean, travel writing is very observational. Comedy is very observational. So there's definitely that element. It's finding ways of looking at things that many, many people have looked at before and finding a different angle, a different way to explain what you're looking at. So in that sense, it's very similar. And I don't think I've ever met a travel writer who doesn't have a sense of humor. So there must be something there. And also, I do know there are a couple of, in the UK, certainly, there are a couple of quite renowned comedy writers who have done travel writing. I mean, obviously, Michael Palin is, you know, very world famous. He's more famous now for travel writing than he is for Monty Python, probably. But there are many more. There's a guy called John Holmes who does a lot of BBC comedy stuff in the UK. He also does a lot of travel writing. So there is some crossover. I'm not sure exactly where it is, but those are the two things that have always kind of tickled my brain. I was an absolute comedy obsessive as a teenager, and then I went traveling. And those have been the two things that have kind of stuck with me, really.
Yeah. I guess as you're talking about it, the thing that came out for me is this idea of, you know, both require astute observation, let's say. Mm-hmm. So perhaps that's the link.
It's finding a way to express. I mean, this is probably true with any creative writing, but it's finding an original way to express a common thing. So as a stand-up or as a comedy writer, you will. You know, I mean, Seinfeld is a perfect example of someone who will make a joke about an egg timer. You know, everyone's seen that, and no one's come up with that exact way of looking at an everyday object or an everyday situation. And with travel writing, you know, not everyone has been to Prague, but there are, you know, millions of articles, blogs, magazine articles about Prague. So how do you find a way to introduce the city or write about it in a way that is not cliched, has not been done a million times? How do you, you know, find a different way of talking about orange rooftops or, you know, snaking rivers or those kind of things? And it's, I think that's the challenge in both is finding that way that people can understand what you're saying. You're not just, you know, willingly using obscure language that everyone has to get out a dictionary and wonder what the hell you're talking about, but is not something that people have read over and over and over again.
Mm. Okay. I mean, I'm really fascinated by it because I have no training. I feel like it's very difficult to write comedy, but I love the idea of it. And I always imagine like, oh, they must have so much fun writing those like Saturday Night Live sketches where you come up with these stupid ideas and be like, now that's of course the rose tinted glasses version. I'm sure it's like, you know, high pressure and you know, all the things like every other career at a level like that. But just the idea of coming up with funny things. And I even see it, you know, like I think the National Park Service in America does a great job on Instagram where they just put some funny things out there that are just like, they're just funny. And I'm just like, oh, I'd like to add more comedy writing into my work. How do I do that? Like, I'm not a comic. So anyway, I might pick your brain on that a little bit at the end, maybe even pitch you on a recent idea I came up with. I want to get your thoughts on this. We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. Here's a quick powerful exercise. If you think about one or two of your big goals, and then you fast forward a few months from now, what can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If one of those goals for you is learning a new language, or even just a little bit of a language to enhance your next trip, you should absolutely get Babbel. They have quick 10-minute lessons handcrafted by over 200 language experts. You can actually start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. It's designed by real people for real conversations, exactly what you want as a traveler. I just downloaded it and went into the Norwegian course area thinking, oh, I've got this. Immediately made a bunch of grammar mistakes that they corrected. And I was like, oh, I've been doing this wrong. So I'm already leveling up and learning. And you can get Babbel now. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/zerototravel. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/zerototravel, spelled BABBEL.com/zerototravel. Rules and restrictions may apply. Thank you to Babbel for supporting today's show. Hey, Jason here. Did you know we have a free weekly newsletter over at zerototravel.com/newsletter? I put my heart and soul into this newsletter and love keeping in touch with listeners off the podcast. That's where you can find out about all of the latest and greatest events, trips we're planning, and of course, you're going to get money-saving travel tips, destination advice, all kinds of stuff to provide value and help you add more travel into your life. So why not sign up? Again, totally free, no cost at all. zerototravel.com/newsletter. Excited to welcome you into that community. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the show. We should get a little bit into this list. I'm not sure how many of them you came up with for Go Here Instead, the book, and we'll link to it, the alternative travel list. And again, I just love this angle that you know, you sent, you had the publisher send over the book, and it's really cool to see how it's laid out. They'll have like in big headlines, like the Wild Atlantic Way, for example, in Ireland, is the alternative to Great Ocean Road in Australia, which I presume is much more crowded and touristed. In travel, I feel like, I mean, it's not just like a trend, or we're like, oh, because of over tourism, you want to go to a less crowded place and all that stuff that we love as travelers. But also, it's just also maybe about having a different kind of travel experience with when it's less touristed, right? Perhaps getting a bit closer to a place in a different way. I feel like there's always going to be the places, you know, you go to Rome and you're probably going to want to see the Sistine Chapel. You're not going to be like, the alternative to the Sistine Chapel is, it's like, well, it's the Sistine, you know, like there's only one of them. So, I mean, like at some point you're always going to, you know, want to go to the thing because that's normal. You know, I'm looking at this one like Greenland as an alternative to Antarctica. If you're wanting to see, you know, glaciers and things like that, and it's not about getting to every continent, well, that's a much more affordable way to get the same magnificence, I guess, or spectacular scenery. And that's somewhat similar. So again, you know, it just depends on you. But and I'm just, so I wanted to hear, how many did you bring today on your personal list? And how did you like create the list? Is it like personal favorites or just like, did you pluck out interesting ones? Like give us the lowdown here, Jill.
So basically, what I did for the book was mostly Central Europe, Central Eastern Europe. So I thought I'd kind of stick to that theme because those are my areas. So most of the guidebooks I write, Central Eastern Europe and UK, particularly Scotland. So I've basically come up with a list, some of which I'm happier with than others. So you can cut down accordingly.
Well, I mean, you can whittle it down if you want. I mean, how many you want to share? Five, should we say, or?
Let's go five. And okay. Then if I have any others, I can chuck them in.
Let's go five. And I'd like to hear maybe a story behind each one if you got one.
Oh,
no,
wow.
No, okay. No pressure, Joe.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, it could also just be more about the philosophy of why you chose it and things like that too. That's totally cool. Let's kick it off. Give us your number five.
Okay. So number five, I would say, the Moselle River instead of the Danube.
Okay.
As a river cruise destination.
River cruise. Okay. I've never done a river cruise.
Oh, okay. So in Europe, it's become a huge thing. The last 5 or 10 years, the amount of, if you go through, I mean, particularly the stretch, the Danube from Vienna to Linz in the northeast of Austria, through Melk and Krems. I mean, it's queues of cruise ships. And you see it if you go to Budapest, if you go to all kinds of places that are really full of river cruises. So it's become a big thing. The Moselle, I still feel, is a little bit underserved and probably less famous than, you know, obviously the Danube, but also like in Germany, possibly the Rhine and the Elbe are maybe better known rivers. The reason I really like the Moselle, I think this western part of Germany is really beautiful. It's wine growing region. So you have these steep hills either side of the river covered in vineyards growing unbelievable Riesling. And it runs down through Luxembourg and into France. But that part of Germany, I was saying before that we used to go on caravan holidays as a kid. So we spend a lot of time in this part of Germany. We went there on a trip when we were maybe 15, or when I was 15, sorry. And then my parents actually bought like a holiday house in a little village on the Moselle.
Oh,
so
really? Okay.
Which wow. they've just sold a few years ago.
That's a personal connection.
Yeah. So that has been a big part of my life, like going back to this area and discovering it. I just think it's very beautiful. And nowadays, I think German wine is probably getting the reputation it deserves. But certainly when I was a kid, you had kind of, there was a brand called Blue Nun, which was famously awful wine. And Hock, I think, was one. But basically, these small producers are just, some of the wine is phenomenal. And so I still, you know, order big packages of 24 bottles that they send over from Germany to our place in the Czech Republic. It's so good. And it's just incredibly beautiful. So that would be, I think that would be one recommendation. Well, so mountain ranges, I think I was struggling to pick one in particular. But I do think, you know, the Western European mountain ranges are very famous, you know, particularly the Alps. People go to French, Swiss, Austrian Alps, occasionally to the Dolomites in Italy, which I think is a little bit underrepresented. It's absolutely beautiful. But I think the mountain ranges in Eastern Europe are really beautiful as well. In Czech Republic, you have Krkonoše, which also goes into Poland, across the border. The Julian Alps in Slovenia, which go right up to Lake Bled, incredibly beautiful. The Tatra Mountains, which is a Poland-Slovakia border. And then obviously the Carpathians in Romania. But there's so many amazing mountain ranges in the east of Europe, which are so much quieter. Although the Tatra, having said that, the Tatras in Slovakia during COVID, when you know, basically people were stuck in their own country, the queues there, that did look like the French Alps. That was insane. But I think now things have settled down a bit now. But I just think that the mountain ranges in Eastern Europe are very overlooked as skiing and hiking destinations. They're all generally very well marked. There's trails everywhere, just, you know, a line of paint on a tree will tell you to follow, you know, follow the blue trail for 40 kilometers to here. And it's just a pleasure. I would highly recommend a hiking or skiing, if that's your thing, trip to Eastern Europe.
Awesome. All right. We've got a river alternative destination and a mountain one. I love it. Mm-hmm. Love it.
So I'll go city break destination. As much as I love Prague, I write about Prague all the time, and you should definitely go to Prague. But if you've been to Prague, or if you're looking for something a bit different, I think Vilnius in Lithuania is a really interesting alternative. It has some similarities. Like, it has it's a really beautiful old town with a castle on top. Has some really good beer, actually. Like, you know, I'm not going to say anything, but Czech beer is the best in the world, because it is. But Vilnius has a really good craft beer scene, and they do a lot of kind of darker beers, stouts and porters, which, coming from the UK, is something I really like. And Czech is very lager. They do have ales, but they're not great generally, whereas the lager is amazing. And I think it's just got, Vilnius just has a really cool kind of alternative vibe. There's this whole breakaway district, which has its own declaration of independence.
Really?
And there's this, it's a really interesting story, actually. And there's this other area, which is kind of a preserved kind of 19th century town. It's all wooden houses, and there's no sewage system or anything, but people still live there. And I think I really like the food. There's a thing called, my Lithuanian isn't great, Cepelinai, I think they call it. Zeppelins, basically. They're like kind of Zeppelin-shaped dumplings, which are kind of grated potato with meat or cheese inside, or curd, and covered in sour cream. And amazing. Really, really nice. I keep saying amazing. I should find some, as a travel writer, I should really have some better adjectives than this.
There are only so many adjectives, I guess. I don't know. No,
that's true.
Sounds epic. I'll say epic. I was going to ask you, how much is a beer in Czech, in Prague nowadays?
Not as cheap as it used to be, but still cheap by most standards. So your basic Pilsner lager,
like a good fresh,
is around 45 crowns, which is €1.50, €1.60.
Okay, yeah, all right.
But
thanks.
When I first came, it was under a euro compared to Norway.
Yeah. I must be a sadomasochist for asking that question. That's all. That's why I'm saying.
Was it 10, 12 euros? What's how much?
Oh,
is it
yeah,
been?
yeah. Depending on what you get, yeah. Between, I mean, 10 would be the low end. You know,
insane.
10 to 15.
I remember with actually one of the earlier trips I did as a teenager, we came to Norway. We went to Bergen. I was a little bit older, actually. I wasn't a teenager. But we didn't really have any money. So we had one beer for the whole week.
It's good for
your
health.
And we lived on 7-Eleven hot dogs.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that was the cheapest food option.
There you go. You got it down. Budget travel in Norway.
There you go.
All right.
Oh, yeah, but top tips for traveling in Norway.
We're down to the last couple here. We had the Moselle. We had the Eastern European mountains. Lithuanian city of Vilnius, are we calling it?
Vilnius. Yeah. I mean, my lisp doesn't really do it justice. Vilnius. Yeah. So my next one, I was going to say, I'm going to move to Scotland and recommend Orkney instead of the Maldives. Slightly facetious phrasing, but basically the scuba diving. If you go to Orkney, obviously you're wearing a dry suit rather than a wetsuit, but the scuba diving in Scarpa Flow, which is this kind of bay near the main island of Orkney, is phenomenal, because basically there was during World War One, there was the German high seas fleet was captured. And it was kept in this bay. And then one night, the captain decided to scuttle the fleet to basically stop the technology getting into British or Allied hands. And so the remains of this fleet are basically on the seabed in this bay around Orkney. So some of them have been lifted, but I'm not sure how many are left, kind of four or five possibly. But you can basically go scuba diving among World War One wrecks. Plus, Orkney is amazing. Like, I mean, another comparison, I guess, would be between the stone circles in Orkney and Stonehenge, because the stone circles there are amazing. I think Orkney is such an amazing destination. It also has one of my... So let's go off on a tangent, but I really like Orkney. there's one other thing is they have this, what they call the Italian church, which is basically Italian prisoners of war. They basically made a church from the from an old shelter. So it's all corrugated iron, and they were allowed to build a Catholic church basically in their downtime, as much as it was. So they kind of polished up concrete to look like marble. And they've kind of melted down bullets to make these kind of gates, and it's just and drawn these frescoes. It's an incredibly beautiful little chapel, all made from basically scrap metal and concrete. It's
wow. Okay.
Very, very cool.
I have to ask you, because it's in the same neighborhood, and my wife, she's been always wanting to go to Shetland because of the Scottish detective series. There's like British detective series. It's not, you know, we get a lot of British culture here in Norway. Mm-hmm. So have you been? Is it worth a visit, or is it all it's cracked up to be? Yeah.
Okay. Shetland's great. I really like Shetland.
Okay.
It's quite a good gateway from Norway to Scotland, because it's kind of quite Scandinavian. They have like a big Viking fire festivals and things in the winter. And the accent is from my perspective, sounds quite Scandinavian as well. It's a really interesting cross culture. It's also the only place where I've ever seen that has an airplane runway crossing. So, you know, you get a train crossing where the barrier comes down.
Yeah.
So that a train can go past.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Really?
They have this for the runway of the airport. So the car has to stop, let the plane land, and then carries on.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, Shetland is very cool. I'd recommend. I mean, Scotland is great, particularly the islands. I write a lot about, probably more about the Western Isles. So Lewis and Harris and Barra and North Uist and all these kind of things, more than Orkney and Shetland. But I've been to most of them. And they're all great. There's not a tree anywhere. It's all very kind of desolate and windswept, but it's beautiful.
There's a romanticism to that landscape as well.
Absolutely.
I'd say. All right. Got one more for us?
Yeah. Well, do you want another Scottish one, or do you want a...
Well, I mean, you tell me. We've got a river one, a mountain one, a city one, and an ocean one. You've done a great job of making this diverse. Is there, you know, I don't know, adventure one?
Oh, now I'm struggling to find another theme.
What would it, a village one? I don't know. You know, what, you tell me.
I've got...
you wrote the book,
maybe,
man.
None of these are in the book, by the way. I wrote about... what I did write about, I can mention, is the Walls of Ston in Croatia, which I think is really interesting. It's very historic. It's kind of the second longest wall after the Great Wall of China. And it's older than the Great Wall of China. So that's really interesting. But I won't focus on that now. The one actually I think might work.
We might as well stay in Europe since we've been in Europe the whole time.
Yes. So there's the Bay of Kotor in Montenegro, which... The comparison I made is Halong Bay in Vietnam.
Oh, okay.
But just because they're bays, right. To be honest, there's not much similarity.
That's a loose interpretation.
That's a very loose comparison. I think that wouldn't have got past the editor though here instead. But, you know.
All right, fair enough. You're being honest about it. So that's the important thing.
but it is, you can explore it yourself. You don't have to pay for a very expensive boat to go around Halong Bay. But anyway, so it's this kind of secluded, sheltered bay. If you travel to Dubrovnik, then it's, I think it's maybe 45-minute drive down the coast across the border into Montenegro. And it's just a beautiful bay. It's backed by mountains. It's looking out into the Adriatic, It's really beautiful. And it has like lots of kind of small little islands that you can go and see. And there's one in particular, which is an artificial island called Our Lady of the Rocks. And it has a church on top of it. And the story is, which depending on who you speak to, is genuine historical fact or myth, possibly somewhere in between. But the story is basically in the 15th century that a group of fishermen, they found an icon of the Madonna and Child, and they put it on, they basically set around creating an island to house this icon. So every day when they went out fishing, they would throw a stone into the water. And when they came back, they'd throw another one. And over, you know, 180 years, I think it was, they had an island that they could then build a church on.
Wow.
And put this icon
is
inside.
That really how it went down, or is that just mythology?
Well, yeah, I don't want to claim 100% historical accuracy, yeah. But I think it's a lovely story.
Yeah, it's a great metaphor, you know.
Yeah, so I think that's really lovely, and the church is beautiful as well. Apparently, another story is that it has this tapestry which is made from the hair of the artist who made it. But generally, I mean, that's one small island, but that bay is somewhere to kind of base yourself for 4 or 5 days and just be on the coast. It's an incredibly beautiful part of Europe that is. Montenegro is becoming more of a destination now the last few years. But I think it's still somewhere you can enjoy, certainly out of peak summer season, that you can enjoy. It's still pretty quiet.
Ah, amazing list. Thank you. So much diversity there. And, you know, this isn't going to be included in the quote unquote official list, but I wanted to ask you somewhere in Europe, if, you know, you've been all over, but let's just keep it to Europe since we've been in Europe this whole time with the list. If you like had to fly somewhere later today and you spend a month somewhere in Europe, where would you go? Just like gut reaction.
Oh, Greece.
Okay.
I don't know where that came from, but that was my gut reaction.
All right.
I think it may be the best food in the world. And it's just beautiful. Yeah. And the history, it's kind of got everything.
Yeah. Very cool. Can you describe British humor? Because I think I get my head around it sometimes and then I'm not sure, but I have come to appreciate it more and more being based here and seeing the pacing and the rhythm and kind of the, I just wanted to hear.
What are you struggling with?
Not really struggling. I want to hear you describe it as a comedy writer and as somebody who grew up with British humor and geeking out on it. Can you describe
it? Weirdly, I did write my dissertation, my thesis at university. I wrote about British sitcom. Quite a lot about the differences between British and American.
Really?
Sitcom.
Oh, okay.
So
I can do
some dissertation at you if you like.
This was a stroke of luck. Yeah, so lay it on me.
I have to remember it now.
What was the conclusion?
I do remember, I know that a lot of British humour is traditionally, I think less so now, but traditionally is class-based, which is obviously, you know, it's not really a system that you have in the US. I mean, you could argue whether you have a class system or not, but certainly this kind of weird hereditary class thing. So a lot of British humour will come from people trying to be perceived as being of a higher class or status than they are.
Oh, I
see. There will be a lot of...
You mean foundationally or the actual humor?
I think that the character... So the character that are kind of creating the comedy, that will be... Their goal will be trying to be something that they're not, trying to be perceived as something that they're not. So, I mean, again, things are changing a lot. I think in some ways, American sitcoms have become more British. And British sitcoms have become more American in recent years. But again, traditionally, if you take The Office as an example, the UK version, US version. So David Brent, the UK version, is a very classic British sitcom character. He's a loser who is trying to be perceived as something that he isn't. So he thinks he's funny, people love him, you know, people look up to him, people respect him. We know that's not true. And a classic British thing is that we're laughing at the characters. We're laughing at this ridiculous person. Whereas I think traditionally, American sitcoms, you're laughing with them. You know, I Love Lucy, Chandler in Friends. You know, you kind of, you might be laughing at some of the things they do, but ultimately they're quite aspirational characters. You know, you wouldn't mind being those people. Whereas in the UK, no one wants to be David Brent or Alan Partridge or Basil Fawlty. These are all people. These are awful people that you don't want anything to do with. And so the American Office, Michael Scott, I would say they've kept some of that stuff of the British side, that you are kind of laughing at him a lot of the time. But he's still, you know, played by a very successful, good-looking man. He is also quite successful at his job. They actually, I think this is right, but as I understand it, I believe there's a point at which after the first series, the writers' room got together and said that it wasn't quite working for an American audience because they didn't understand why Michael Scott kept his job, because he didn't seem to be any good at it. So they put in this whole thing early in the second series where he goes out on a sales call and he does really well. And everyone's like, wow, okay, this guy, I understand why this person is kept in his job, though he does all these awful things.
Yeah.
Whereas the British one, they didn't need to do that, because the idea that somebody who is fundamentally useless is at the top of a company, that's not an alien concept to us. That's just life. That makes sense. Yeah, that's just life. And this awful person that's just hangs around, that's just, yeah, that's fine.
That's hilarious.
So I think those are some kind of small fundamental things. Again, I would say traditionally it's quite laughing at people. So a lot of kind of sarcasm and irony and a lot of kind of, I think it's true in both cases that a lot of humor comes from the more obscure references you make,
yeah, right,
which therefore can make things a bit impenetrable, because American culture is so global that, you know, you kind of know, even if you don't, you know, I've never been to a Wendy's, they don't exist as far as I'm aware in Europe, but yeah. You kind of know what it is because you've seen it in a dozen films.
I see.
TV.
Okay.
But
yeah.
If, you know, a British sitcom is talking about, I don't know, Walker's Crisps or
right,
or Rover cars.
It doesn't mean anything to us.
You know, yeah, other people are just like, okay. And that's fine occasionally to have that. But when a lot of the humor, I think Alan Partridge is a good example of one that doesn't translate very well. Massively successful sitcom in the UK. I think a lot of American comedy fans love it, but has never had mainstream success, because a lot of the humor is based on him being a very kind of parochial Little Englander kind of character who makes a lot of references to quite obscure nostalgic brands and things like that. And it doesn't translate.
That's a great breakdown, man. I mean, you just enlightened me. So next time I'm watching some of these shows, I'll give it a, yeah, I think that was so well said. You reminded me that I actually wrote a paper in college too. I totally forgot about this, on the shift in humor. In the United States, and the comparison I used was Tom and Jerry, the cartoon Tom and Jerry. Do you remember Tom and Jerry? Mm-hmm. They were like a cat.
I do. Mouse.
And Beavis and Butthead.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which is two totally different styles of cartoon, of course. But I forgot about that. Okay, so yeah, here's my pitch I came up with. Because I was like, you know, how do you write a joke, man? Maybe you can give me some advice here. But I just for fun, I came up with this idea the other day. What if there were like American fortune cookies, you know, like American-based fortune cookies, and you'd pull them out and they'd be, you know, Americanized fortune. So you could have one that's like a prophecy that says, the next time you go to a Walmart, you will be lovingly greeted at the front door. for example.
That's very nice.
Maybe there's something there. I don't know.
I like that. Maybe we can team up. We can do some British ones that say, don't even try. It's not worth it.
There you go. Anyway, fun exercise. I watch a lot of stand-up and I admire it all, but I've never studied it and I never tried to write anything and I don't know how you do it.
I think, well, I've not done stand-up because inherently terrifies me. Someday I will, possibly. But, I mean, I think really the best thing you can do is go and do stand-up. You'll very quickly learn because you have a live audience telling you whether something's funny or not.
Yeah, but you still need to write all the jokes, you know?
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. But I mean, it's in terms of a theater for learning.
What's the deal better. With... Sorry, I'm not going to do that.
But the thing is, like, if you sit down and try and write something and it's not funny, then there's no consequences to that. Whereas if you stand up on the stage and say something that's not funny, you will quickly learn to write things that are better than that It's so excruciating.
Yeah.
Having to stand there for 5 minutes with no one laughing.
Right. Unless like that's
my tip. Go do stand up.
Unless you're doing like the, you know, the performance art kind of like, you know, you're purposely making it awkward. So it becomes so awkward that after a while it just becomes funny because of the awkwardness. That's such a talent too, to create like so much awkwardness that it becomes funny that's a weird space, a weird energy.
Yeah, it is. But there's a craft to that. I don't think it's just someone standing up and saying unfunny things for 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. It's like to be able to like actually intentionally do that is a talent in and of itself, I think. Cool, man. I really enjoyed chatting with you today. I wanted to give a shout out to the book one more time, Go Here Instead, The Alternative Travel List. And you have many books and we'll link up to your site and everything. I liked that you used Philadelphia, my hometown, as an alternate to New York City. So thanks. Shout out to Philly. Last two questions, really light ones. What matters most in life?
Oof. How cheesy can I be?
As cheesy.
I think probably family. That's very cheesy. Laughter. Let's go laughter.
No, there I don't go. Think family's cheesy. It's heartfelt. Family and laughter. Okay.
Yeah. The two go hand in hand. Well, they should do anyway.
Is there a word or phrase or mantra or general philosophy that you are living by nowadays?
Yeah, I think getting out of your comfort zone, I think, is quite a good guide to life. And that's with, I think most things that have come, good things that have come, to me, that's very weird phrasing, but I think it is basically those situations where I've put myself in, the times where I've put myself in situations which are you know, not comfortable. So traveling is part of that. Just traveling to places which are, you know, not easy. Also, you know, when I went to teach English in Nepal, deciding to travel solo in different places. Trying to become a comedy writer and seeing your work up on stage, all that stuff is uncomfortable, but you learn and you fail quite a lot, but it's all a learning curve. And second mantra would be embrace failure 100%. If you want to do anything creative, you will be rejected a lot more than you'll be successful. You know, for every travel article pitch I've sent to editors, you know, 1 in 10 maybe makes it through. For every, you know, comedy idea you pitch or, you know, even less than that probably. So you need to be comfortable with not being successful and also know that it's not a necessary reflection on you personally or your talent. It is just about other people who have other priorities. You can't control that. Just keep going, and if you're okay at what you do, then you'll get there in the end.
Love that advice. Last one, number one travel tip.
Go. I think
one word.
You know, it's go. Yeah, it's easy to not go. There are a million reasons not to travel. Life is much more comfortable if you just stay where you are, or you go to the easiest place you can. But it's also much less interesting.
Cool. Thanks so much for your time today, Joe.
And, thank you. And
again, if you want to learn more about Joe's work, josephrini.com. We'll link up to it in the show notes, as well as the agency you mentioned and some of the comedy stuff you've done. And appreciate your time, and hope we get to meet up in person at some point somewhere in the world. Do this again.
Yes, me too. Great. Thanks very much, Jason.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Have it. I want to thank Joe Rini for stopping by the show. Loved hearing his list, and the book once again is Go Here Instead. We'll link to all of that in the show notes, as well as everything we mentioned. One of my favorite alternative destinations. I mean, it's not so off the beaten path, but I had the pleasure of visiting Nicaragua a while back, and I had been to Costa Rica years before that, and I found that, of course, you know, with these alternative destinations, it's a different culture, different food, different people, of course, all of that. But I was there for a surfing holiday, and I was looking for those Central American vibes, and I was able to get them at a much more affordable price. Wonderful beach, great people, good food. And that's the thing with these other places. They're not going to be the place that they're replacing. They're going to be different, but maybe, to kind of wrap this up, it's just that these alternative destinations offer some kind of similarities in terms of the vibes, the types of experiences you can have, of course, in a completely different setting, and a lot of value in going to places where most travelers are not going. So that's why I wanted to share this list with you today. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a fun one to put together. I'll leave you with a quote on not following the crowds in the spirit of this episode. This one's from Matshona Diwayo, who said, "Don't run with the crowd, fly with the stars." Thanks for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day. I'll see you next week. Peace and love to you and yours. Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.